London dropped its dignity.
Yeah.
So has France and Germany.
Yeah.
All hands are dancing to a raggedy melody full of originality.
Sing it, though.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to yesterday's Chip Paper, a fortnightly-ish podcast where we look through old newspapers for the macabre and the strange and the bizarre and anything that tickles our respective fancies. I'm Jim.
And I'm Violet. And we're a couple of amateur researchers who are usually on opposite sides of the Atlantic. But Jim is home for the holidays.
I am home. So we are in the same room recording this for the first time in the short history of this podcast. We're at a great recording studio in Camden with a very helpful chap on the front desk.
Where we have loads of really high-tech equipment surrounding us. And yet, for various reasons, are still using a scarf and a glove as pop guards.
Yep.
Over iPhone microphones.
I see podcasting very much as a cottage industry rather than anything professional. So that's where we are. We're using winter gear as pop shields in a recording studio in Northwest London. Now, for our show we're doing in London together, I wanted to push the boat out, and you'll find that was an excellent pun shortly.
That's just, it's setting the level for the rest of the podcast to come. Hold on to your seats.
No. That is the last attempt I'll make at a joke through this podcast. So I was doing research for another story, actually, for this episode. And I'd done all my research, and I'd written it up, and I was ready to go. And then the last article that I looked at featured a story. It's the story that I'm going to use today, which is one of the darkest stories that I've read, and for some reason is almost completely forgotten about. Somebody wrote a book about it, a novelization in 2010, but other than that, there's very little about it online, which means that all of the research that I did today came from the newspapers, which means that, you know, there might be some unreliable stuff in there. So I've tried my best to make it as historically accurate as possible, but he's kind of, you know, there are a few flaws in the sources. Anyway, it is the story of a ship, an Irish ship called the Mary Russell, which is what all Irish ships must have been named. Irish women, Irish ships, Mary.
In conversations got really confusing.
Has it?
No, I mean, that conversation would be really confusing.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Have you seen Mary? I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. I'm not going to tease this out. In 1828, the captain lost his mind, and he systematically and brutally murdered 7 crew members. And really, one of the amazing things, given that this is a crime that's 200 years old, the newspapers are full of true witness and survivor testimony from those that were actually there on the ship, people who he didn't murder, obviously. It's really, really horrible. I'm also relieved not to be covering the untimely death of a woman again, because that would not be a reputation that I would want.
I'm also relieved.
Yeah.
Having just been sealed inside a tiny little soundproof studio.
Hi. The man obsessed with women getting murdered is a Facebook group that when you join it, you should just be on a list that you can never be removed from. All right, so are you ready to hear this awful, awful story?
I'm ready.
You're ready? Good.
I'm prepared.
Okay. You're standing.
I feel really weird. I feel like
you're standing.
Jim is currently like crouched in a corner because the only surface where he can sit his laptop to read the story is a chair.
It's a school
which
chair.
For some reason is facing the corner.
I'm not making eye contact with anybody.
I'm looking
for the next hour.
Looking at the back of a crouched man.
A crouched man obsessed with
the murder
of young
women. Saying
that
he is not obsessed with the murder of women. But yes, so, I'm ready.
I am going to transport you back to February 1828, which every man had scurvy and everything smelled. The ship is the Mary Russell, which is a wooden brig that sailed from Cork to Barbados, and it transported mules one way and sugar the other. The mules from Ireland, and that is the way around that you want it. We'll probably call Mary.
The mules would have loved that.
What, the ship?
Leaving cold Ireland for sunny Barbados. That's why they had to do it that way round, because the mules wouldn't have come with them.
No. Nobody from Barbados is holidaying in Cork. So on the return leg, I'm just going to sit myself down on the actual ground, I think. On the return leg of the journey. That's good stuff. It was my birthday recently, so I'm advancing in years, so my knees aren't what they were. On the return leg of the journey, the captain, who is a man called William Stewart, which you'll also see spelled, you'll see it spelled S-T-E-W and S-T-U-A, depending where you read it. In fact, the article that I found about this this incident from 50 years in the future, not my future, their future.
I haven't got there yet.
This would be a much better podcast. They spelled it S-T-U, so it's worth searching both.
So either clan can claim him.
Yeah. Or claim they're not related to him. So anyway, Captain Stewart started fearing that there was a mutiny afoot. And this fear was born out of a dream that he had. And he convinced himself that that was enough for him to just kill everyone. The Globe newspaper on the 15th of August, 1828, has all the court transcripts from his trial. So a lot of stuff is going to come from there. The first mate, William Smith, in the trial, obviously he survived, said, "About a week after we sailed," and this is on the home voyage from Barbados, "about a week after we sailed, Captain Stewart said to me that he dreaded the people were about to murder both of us, and that he had been led to that opinion from dreams which he had had. Upon which I replied, it was a folly to mind dreams, as they uniformly proved false and fanciful."
That was wise. I'm with him on that one.
Yes, and he spares him. kind of spares him. So the captain, this is when things started to go awry. The captain has told the first mate that their lives are in danger because he dreamt it. And then it just...
See, if all of my dreams came true, I'd just, like, have no teeth.
Yeah, right, and now. I would have no teeth and I would not be wearing clothes.
People wouldn't be able to walk the streets safely because I'd just be in control of a car with no brakes.
I had a dream recently that I stole an old woman. And that's genuinely a dream.
Is that not kidnap?
No, I think I'd thought of it as theft. I think I justified it by it being theft rather than a more serious crime. She was mean. She was trying... Jesus Christ. I don't have dogs in my apartment, but she was trying to get me to give up my dogs that I had in my apartment. So I left the dogs with my mum and I stole an old woman. And at some stage during the dream, we attended a wedding together, even though she obviously didn't want to because she'd been stolen. So if my dreams came true, then I wouldn't be here recording this right now. Anyway, Jesus. So after this point, after his dream, where he steals an old woman, everything went wrong very, very quickly. There was another captain on the ship who was just a passenger. He was just coming back from Barbados, Captain Raines. And Raines was speaking Irish with a member of the crew because the member of the crew didn't speak English very well. Stewart didn't speak Irish. He was a Protestant. I think he was British. So he didn't like this at all. And William Smith, the first mate, in his court's transcript, he says, "I had heard Captain Stewart expostulate with Captain Raines on account of his having spoken Irish to the crew, upon which Raines said he should not have done so if he thought it offended Captain Stewart, who immediately said he would throw overboard the log, glasses, reels and charts of the ship, and in a short time they were thrown into the sea."
Okay.
You need those. I'm not a 19th century mariner, and stop saying I am, but I think you do need those.
He sounds like a kind of nautical version of Google as an employer. He's just like, let's throw all the rules out the window. Let's have beanbags and pizza Fridays.
I feel like he's more like a nautical Chairman Mao.
take either.
Yeah, they're the same. Another newspaper, the Cork Constitution, reported that Stewart said he threw these out to, and I quote, "show Raines something." Raines being the other captain.
Showing Raines something.
I'm incompetent, sir. You're a better captain than me, Raines. Smith says all this happened within a week or two of reaching Cork. So what's happened so far? They're trapped at sea with a man who believes his dreams and has just thrown all the navigational equipment into the actual sea.
Ideal.
He also requested that Smith stop keeping a ship's log. And if this was a movie, you'd be like, ugh. So this foreshadowing is a bit heavy-handed.
And what, they just stopped keeping a log?
Stopped keeping a log then. Yeah, everything now is witness testimony. And there's another incident where Smith again. He lit, there's a binnacle or binnacle lamp on a ship that's on the deck somewhere, I don't really know. And it was bad weather, so it went out. And Smith went up to light it again and went out again, and he went up to light it the third time. And the captain said that it was odd that he was going up and down ladders so many times, and asked him if he was going to retrieve implements with which to kill the captain. And he was like, it's not,
oh
my
God.
Not my fault it's bad weather. I think he actually said, it's not my fault it's bad weather. But by this stage, the captain had sent a crew member to fetch harpoons and a carpenter's axe. And he's now just walking around the ship with a dolphin harpoon and a carpenter's axe. And loaded pistols.
Is a dolphin harpoon not like quite heavy?
It's cuter. Cuter than a whale harpoon, I think. More intelligent. I have no idea. I guess they're quite heavy. But I suppose it's like easier than carrying around a whaling harpoon, which would be... Hang on, why do they have dolphin harpoon?
Huh?
Why did they have one? They were transporting sugar.
In case a dolphin came to steal the sugar?
Just the wily dolphin.
Meanwhile, this guy's walking around on deck with just a dolphin harpoon over his shoulder.
Yeah.
Just whenever he turns around, you've suddenly got a harpoon facing you.
All the dolphins on board are like, don't go near him, don't go near him. Leave his sugar. So then the following day, the captain cracked. He hadn't yet cracked, and now he cracked. Early in the morning, So where Smith was sleeping, the first mate, who he was suspected of leading mutiny, I guess, he had the hatch open to Smith's sleeping quarters in the hold, and he asked if he was in there. And the court constitution reported on June 28th, 1828. Smith answered that he was, to which the captain replied, it was well for him, for if he was forward amongst the people, he would put him to death as a mutineer. He, the captain, had a harpoon in his hand, which he presented at the breast of the witness when he came on deck and said he would stick it into him. He further said the witness was making a mutiny in the ship, to which witness replied that he was always the captain's trusty friend, and it was singular that he should suspect him now of being a ringleader. He, the captain, then shook hands with all the crew and said they were all honest but the witness, which is Smith. Yeah.
He sounds like an 8-year-old in the playground.
Yeah, you're all right. You're all right. You're not all right. You're all right. You're all right. I'm trying to find where I was in this article. That's why.
Just keep going.
You're all right.
You're all right.
It's you again, Smith. You're not. I told you you're not. Stop running around people.
Stop joining the line again.
The captain called all hands on deck about 2 hours afterwards and told the people to lash the witness's hands behind his back. The crew hesitated to obey him, and one of them, Frank Sullivan, said, if we lash the mate without reason, that he would take the law of us when we came home. He would be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Another man, John Howes, and more on him later, said he did not see anything the matter with the mate, and the men then all walked away. The witness went below.
Huh.
Yeah.
They would see that. Yeah,
I think
they drew the line at what was it he was asking them to do?
To tie the witness's hand. Yeah.
So they drew the line at that, but they did throw everything overboard.
The boys did that. The actual sailor didn't. But I do wonder now
those damn kids.
I do wonder now if this is mutiny once they refuse to do what the captain says. Again, though, I'm not a 19th century. So, sometime after, Keating and the second mate Swanson and Connell came down to the witness and said he had better be lashed, as the captain was getting such a rage. The witness then went on deck and said to the captain, here, tie away. That's the end of the article, so no, this is now me. None of the men on the ship would do it. So Smith said, you don't need a man, a boy will do. So there, the second mate, a guy called William Swanson, I think it was like 11, tied Smith up. And all the sources reported that, in fairness to Swanson, he wasn't happy about it. But by this stage, the captain had two loaded...
And he was 11.
And he was 11.
And he had a guy pointing a dolphin harpoon at him.
Well, no, by this stage, it was two loaded pistols.
Ah.
So people were just terrified of him. People were doing whatever. Yeah, and the kid's 11, like, you know. And he's raised to respect authority figures, I guess. So Smith was lashed in the cabin. He wasn't given any food or water for a few days. At one stage, he did complain that his lashes were too tight and they were loosened, which was one of the captain seems to have, like, these moments of sanity where he was like, oh god, yeah, I bet they are too tight. Loosen them. So then, and this is bad. Nothing so far has been as bad as this. So the captain then called each man down to him one at a time. He threatened them with pistols, made them admit that they were plotting a mutiny, and tied them up like Smith. And they were tied to staples that he'd had put in the floor deliberately for this purpose, so this was planned, and with really heavy duty rope.
Really heavy duty staples.
Really heavy duty, yeah. Like,
not like those W.H. Smith ones you get these days.
No, you need like six of those to do this. He toyed with them. He offered them a longboat to escape in, but he never untied them.
You know what? I think at this point, a mutiny is allowed.
Yeah, I
it's
think...
It's actually fine.
At least a workplace tribunal.
You at least got to go to HR with
that one. Discuss this with HR. So Scully, who was the other one of the boys, said that the men weren't in bad humour, actually, which means I think they just assumed they would just get back to Cork and then they would be able to report this whole thing. which they didn't, by the way. But then there's this guy...
Spoiler alert.
...who was mentioned earlier called John Howes.
Mm-hmm.
And the Globe quotes, and these are quotes, these are things that he said. They quote Howes in the trial. Good God. So he called the captain called Howes up and talked about him being tied up. And Howes says, "I was about to comply when he said, 'Avast,' which you have to say at sea. And he pointed two pistols at me. 'What do you want of those pistols, sir?' said I. 'You shall soon know,' was the reply. And he immediately snapped them both at me. So he fired both. One burnt in the pan and the other did not go off. I retreated and said, 'Recollect, Captain Stewart, that you have snapped two pistols at me.' And no.
Like a popgun. Yeah. Snapped.
I wouldn't have stopped there to have repartee. I'd have run off. I retreated and said, 'Recollect, Captain Stewart, that you have snapped two pistols at me. And know that I shall have recourse to the law for satisfaction for such act when I reach Cork.' I probably wouldn't go with the man who's trying to shoot me."
Do you think those were his exact words? Because those are very calm and collected words for a guy who's just been shot.
No, I think probably... he just stood there open-mouthed and went... in about 5 minutes, he followed me, preceded by two boys, and said, "You must now allow yourself to be tied." "Why, sir, what have I done?" "No matter," said he, "but if you don't submit, I shall brand you as a ringleader in the mutiny." I then submitted, permitting myself to be tied, legs and hands. I told him I would not injure him for the world. He said he did not care, that Captain Rains and Cornell had acknowledged a piracy. "I am ignorant, sir, of any such intention," said I. "Why, John," said he, "I should like to take you into Cork with a whole skin." "Sir," said I, "I wish a British man of war would near us so that you could discontinue your capers." "I wish so too," was his reply. Right.
Oh.
So these aren't the bits that actually...
He wished so too. So... Sorry, another moment of clarity.
But yeah, you're right. That is quite sad because it's like, yeah, no, I wish someone...
Yeah.
I wish something could stop me doing this. Maybe he wasn't thinking
not
that
me,
all.
But
maybe
else.
He was just like, "More men to kill." So Captain Stewart took Howe's knife, and Howe was tied to the deck. During the night, he was so cold that the captain agreed to move him inside. During the night, Howe managed to free one of his hands, and the captain found out in the morning. And then, quoting Howe in the Globe,
"Did he manage to do anything with his free hand?"
No, he just wanted to move his arm around. I think it's just really uncomfortable. I think they're spread eagled. "In the morning, he came to me, and finding one of my hands disengaged, said he should retie me. 'I shall resist you, sir,' I replied, 'for if I suffer myself to be lashed again as I had been last night, I shall certainly die of the pain.' He endeavoured to elicit an acknowledgement from me of participating in the supposed mutiny, which I disclaimed, upon which he fired four shots at me, one of which struck me on the foot, another in the right breast, one on the right side, and the fourth
Jesus.
In my belly." Yeah, honestly.
So he's not in good shape.
Oh, but no, you can't kill John Howes. I called out that the last two had entered my entrails, and I stretched out, apparently dying, for I determined to assume the appearance of death should my wounds not even not prove fatal. He told a boy to look over me and ascertain if I were dead, and if the blood flowed from me. I remained in one position for half an hour, and having discovered that my wounds were not mortal, he just waited to see. Like,
oh, that's grim.
I changed the position of my right hand. At this time, I saw that John Deaves observed me to stir, a circumstance from which I anticipated the worst of results.
Was he one of the boys?
Yes, I think so. Yes. Finding that there was little chance of escape and was about to see what was to be done, when Captain Stewart looked down and said, "This fellow is not dead," and again fired at me. "The ball of that shot is now in my thigh."
Jesus.
"That will do," said I. "No," said he, "it will not, but I'll soon make it do." I then summoned up what strength I possessed, darted upon my feet, which I unloosed by a great effort, and afterwards disengaged my hand. Captain Stewart, preceded by three boys, all armed, approached me. I groped about for something to defend myself.
Oh my God.
I could find nothing for that purpose but a box of seashells, which I held up to my belly in order, if he fired, that no part of my body in which the shot would prove mortal should be hit. He did fire, and my precaution was a successful one, having warded off the bullet.
No!
Yes! He then urged the boys to thrust their harpoons and axes at me. "Boys," said I, "don't be instrumental in my murder." I rushed forward and knocked Stewart down. And then, this is me again, this isn't the newspaper. A serious fight ensued. Only one of the parties had been shot several times.
Oh my God. And then warded off another bullet with boxes, seashells.
I just used those for crafts. So yeah, Howes rushed him, and they had a fight. The captain lost one of his pistols, and when he dropped it, it fell into the hold. At one point, Howes was trying to rip Stewart's cheek with his fingers, like fish hooking him. and Stuart was trying to bite his finger off. And during the melee, one of the boys, who was terrified of Captain Stuart, struck Howes several times about the head with the sharp edge of an axe.
The sharp edge being the blade?
Yeah.
Okay.
During the struggle, this is a quote from Howes, "During the struggle, I was struck several times in the head by one of the boys with a sharp instrument like an axe. The blood flowed down my face so fast that I became almost blinded and was thereby prevented from using my exertions."
How is he still alive?
I don't know. How is he giving evidence? I think he did actually die before the trial.
Yes, sir. Then he ripped my heart out. I managed to gather up all my entrails before I left.
As I turned, he was eating my spleen. But the best bit about this fight is that I've written, "In the confusion, Captain Stuart fled." Captain Stuart ran away from his man, who had shot five times and been hit around the head with an axe. Howes ran away, which, fair enough, run away. And he hid amongst the sugar in the cargo hold, and they didn't find him. The boy who hit Howes, Rickards, the captain kissed him and said he'd be up for a substantial reward when they hit shore, and that the captain himself was in for thousands of pounds from Lloyd's in insurance, I think.
And the boy's just like, "Nah, it's okay. Yeah. It's absolutely fine. Yeah. You would have done the same for me.
You can't put a value on life.
Please stop kissing me."
Yeah. this is when the captain descends further. He's like in, this is when he like loses hope and he goes into just real like berserker mode. They saw a ship in the distance and they flew their flags in the traditional way that is like a distress signal for ships. And the ship ignored them. And then they saw another ship and that ignored them as well, which apparently was really, really unusual. So the captain became convinced that God had cursed them, which for the people tied down is good news. So then upon being convinced they were cursed, the captain just knocked a crew member out with a crowbar. It just hit him in the head with a crowbar, a guy called Swanson. And then this is what happened. He killed Merley, Kramer, Sullivan, Keating, Connell and Captain Rames.
Oh.
He took the cook's axe and went round them and beat out their brains. He went to Captain Rames and struck him repeatedly on the face and eyes with the crowbar. While killing them, he only called out, "You ruffians, you ruffians. You were going to take my life, but I'll take yours." He did not seem to be much in a passion, but the perspiration was falling off his face. He then took the crowbar and a harpoon to the cabin door and struck the mate repeatedly, after which he put his hand on his neck and, finding it cold, he said that he was done. He then desired the witness to bring the beef to him, and having cut some slices off, he drank grog and smoked his pipe over the dead bodies.
What?
Yeah. He then had Deeves called down, and he, the captain, raised his hand and said, "Look, boys, at my hand, how steady it is. I think no more of killing them than if they were dead dogs."
Jesus.
That's from the Western
Times.
Well,
you can't kill a dead dog, but technically.
That's true, actually. Someone should have corrected him. That's from the Western Times on the 5th of July, 1828. All these sources are British newspaper archive. And that's witness testimony from one of the boys. So the mate that they talked about, him thinking he was dead, what actually happened with him was that when he was tied up, he requested an air hole in the deck. So they drilled him an air hole. And the captain just put a harpoon through this air hole. He saw Smith through the hole and stuck the point of the crowbar down at him. This is a quote again from the court constitution, which went through the collar of the witness's shirt near his neck and through the leg of his trousers. I don't know how he was dressed. I think he did it twice. He afterwards struck him with the point of a harpoon, cut his head and ears, and kept working it until he cut his left eye and ear and took a piece out of his shoulder. Witness then had the appearance of being dead, which Captain Stuart remarked, but said he did not think he was quite dead, and that he would give him more, on which he broke the deck with the crowbar and pushed the harpoon at him again, but missed, and it passed him and stuck into some hides, which he thought was into the witness, and he repeated the stabs of it and said he was dead for good. He then...
For a guy armed with so many weapons, he's really not very good at actually finishing people off.
He's not good at anything. He's not successfully done anything. I mean, he's killed a few people. They were tied down. He then put his hand back of his neck and found it quite cold, and then nailed a bit of deal plank, no idea, over the hold. He then had his supper, had a glass of grog, and went to bed. When he heard him retire, he, Smith, put his hand in his pocket and contrived to cut his cords, after which he scrambled to the forehold and there remained until he got relief and was put on board a British-American schooner. So the rest of the crew did get rescued, by a ship called the Mary Stubbs.
So how many are left alive at this point?
Three boys, the captain, Smith and Howes, I think. So Howes survived in the hold, hidden amongst the sugar. Smith survived, the guy who he kept stabbing through that hole. But to quote Howes, "When I returned to the deck, having been relieved by the Mary Stubbs, I for the first time heard of the slaughter of the seven men, being told of it by Smith, the mate, who asked me how I got on. And upon my telling him, he said he himself was half dead, having been left for killed by Captain Stewart, who knocked one of his eyes out, one of his ears off, and beat him desperately with a crowbar."
Ugh.
He lost an eye and an ear, and was still walking around telling people what had happened. such hard men.
Who were this crew?
Yeah, no,
where were they hired from?
I'm wondering if it was already a ghost ship. and a horrible little detail, the harbour master at Cork was Captain Raine's brother. So
he's the guy who was like really knocked right at the end
Yeah,
of it.
He was killed.
Was he killed?
He was killed, very much so. And the captain had a real problem with him, so I imagine it was quite horrible what happened to him. The Cork Constitution, when they heard about this happening, they sent a reporter to the inquest. So they were there when the ship arrived. And so Captain Raine's brother had to receive a ship. And this is how the Cork Constitution describes it. "There were seven human beings with their skulls so battered that scarcely a vestige of them was left for recognition, with a frightful mass of coagulated blood all strewed about the cabin and nearly 100 weight of cords binding down their bodies to strong iron bolts which had been driven into the floor for that murderous purpose. Some of the bodies were bound round in 6 places with several coils of rope around their necks, and all were in a state of decomposition, so that it required a constitution of no ordinary strength to bear up against the spectacle and the effluvia that arose from the confined cabin."
So the people at the port are just like, "So we can't use the sugar."
No one's buying this. That's okay.
This is like Turkish Delight was invented.
Yeah. There's mules.
Had to offset the pinkish hues.
There's mules on the harbour just like, "We'll wait for the next one." Actually, so Stewart was arrested. Obviously, where's he going to go? And he pleaded guilty. No, he didn't. He confessed.
Okay.
Sorry, he confessed to the murder of seven men. But when he went to trial, he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, which
probably
sounds pretty insane. So he was found not guilty, and he was sent to a criminal insane asylum, where a few years later, he had another episode and he murdered a hospital cell attendant. Yeah, he killed somebody else. He just couldn't help it. It just sounds like he was...
Oh, God.
He just had such deep problems, and obviously the framework didn't exist then, I guess.
I don't know what happened, like... before all of this. We'll have to do a prequel.
We'll have to do, what, Captain Stewart Origins?
Yeah.
Just a man really annoyed by people speaking. He's just a guy who's scared of maps. But the saddest thing, other than the tragic murder of seven men, because there were sailors, you know, this is 1828, there's no, like, pensions or trade unions and things. There's maybe some kind of union, but so there's no money for the families. So if you read the newspapers around the trial, the Southern Reporter and Cork Commercial Courier on the 21st of August 1828 has an advert that is asking for money for the families, subscriptions for the families of the sufferers on board the Mary Russell. And you can contribute to the mayor, the sheriff and officers of the Southern Reporter and Constitution, because they just had no money and there was no work and they had kids and things.
Did anyone do so?
Yeah, I think so. I did read somewhere that some money had been raised. But yeah, so that's
tragic.
That is the story of the Mary Russell. And I don't know, I didn't make enough of this, but the ship that saved them was the Mary Stubbs. Which is another Irish ship called the Mary.
Good old Mary.
Yeah, so... Yeah, and that story.
That's horrifying.
And that has been totally forgotten about. I actually, not totally, because that guy wrote a book about it a few years ago, but I can't believe I've never... even heard of it. Like the Wikipedia page, I looked on Wikipedia. The reason that all of the research is through the newspapers is because there just isn't that much research. The Wikipedia page is a couple of hundred pages. Yeah, and it's...
You mean words?
Jesus, yeah.
I was like, that's pretty substantial.
That's a lot of research, actually, yeah. A couple of hundred words and...
That's nuts.
For a comparison, the other mutiny that I was looking at was a ship called the Lenny, which might feature in a future episode, but that three guys died on that. And I would say that the... it was probably a bigger scandal, but the Wikipedia article was like 4 times longer.
So that's all from the papers. What year was that?
1828. 1828, and it's amazing to me that, yeah, that was all from the newspapers.
And you've got all the kind of witness testimonies.
Witness testimony.
Not even just people writing, not even reporters at the trial, but actually, well, I mean, it's reporters at the trial, but
yeah,
the actual spoken words. That's insane.
And yeah, we have like primary source evidence from a mass murder on a ship.
That you happen to come across in another article.
Yeah, that's the most nuts
thing.
When
you think about what must be, like, what else is in that archive.
Exactly. Exactly, because I've been using the British Newspaper Archive, and they're heading towards, like, 17 million pages. So it's just, it's near infinite. It's a practically infinite resource of things like this. And this for me is like, you know, it's sort of like a dream coming across something like this, which is morbid, but I think it's not too soon.
Yeah, I think a couple of hundred years is safe.
That's our buffer. So yeah, so that is the tragic, tragic story of the Mary Russell and Captain Stewart. If you want to read more about it, a book was written by Alana Hopkin and Kathy Bunny in 2010. It was called The Ship of Seven Murders. So if you want to check that out, we'll put a link up in the show notes. So that is my awful story. In fact, the last two that I've had have been Catherine Hayes, who was the incestuous murderer, and now the captain of a ship who murdered seven of his crew. And I'm hoping that my next one will be a dog who gets his pilot's license.
I mean, start researching now.
Yeah.
And in a couple of weeks, who knows?
Who knows, Jesus. All right, so moving on from that harrowing escapade, what have we got in letters this week? What is in the mailbox?
Well, we've got one in today from a listener from 1863.
Ooh.
It's a lot lighter than yours, so that's okay. Good.
That's all right.
It ran in the Sterling Observer on the 19th of March. Under the headline, A Martyr to Cat Gut Scraping.
Ooh.
And it says, Dear Mr. Editor, have you ever been troubled by a musical neighbour? If not, feel for me. My musical neighbour lives under me and treats me every night to what he calls a few select tunes on the violin. But the sound as it reaches me at my own fireside, as I sit looking into my wife's face with my teeth pressed together in perfect agony.
Just that's how he spends his evenings, just staring at
his
wife's
face. Oh yeah, this was
face.
Like before the violin started.
This was before TVs, I just stared at my wife.
Is the nearest approach to the noise made by a saw when in the hands of a joiner cutting through a 9-inch plank that I have ever heard in this world.
Wow.
I do not object to music. On the contrary, I am a great admirer of fine music and believe that music tends to refine the coarser parts of human nature and lift the mind away heavenwards. And I should say to every young man and woman to cultivate music, as it is the only accomplishment that will be required in futurity. But what I object to, dear Mr. Editor, is being sawed to death in so cruel a manner. And I should also just stop here to note that the next thing I say is the final sentence of the letter.
Okay.
That was the last full stop for a while.
Oh, Jesus.
I have heard of people being bored to death, but, except in Holy Writ, I have not heard of a case of sawing to death. And as my musical neighbour has a musical cat to assist him, which sets up a kind of mewing that would frighten a nervous person into fits, and added to this, a musical son of this family of Mozarts, who plays on what the vulgar term crackers, you will have an idea of my musical miseries. And, dear Mr. Editor, as I know that you are always willing to lend a helping hand to put down all nuisances and pretentious humbugs, I trust I shall not appeal to you in vain to take this discordant matter into your harmonious consideration, and by doing so save all musical ears from torment and violence from being used as saws. I am yours, etc., Timothy Tompkins.
Do you know what I heard when you read that really long letter out?
Mm.
I heard, I'm too scared to go and ask my neighbour to be quiet. I'm going to write a passive-aggressive letter to the local newspaper in the hope that he recognises that he is the wielder of the saw.
And then the editor actually wrote back saying that there was a band called the Sterling Serenaders who were performing at the Corn Exchange, and he suggested that he get someone who played a trombone to come and play it at the same time.
God.
Which would definitely solve the problem.
Yeah, that's like the lady who swallowed a spider. or whatever it was.
An old lady who's swallowed a fly.
Yeah, you get a trombone, and then you've got to get like a cello and violin combination, and then you're talking harpsichords,
bagpipes,
tubas. All right, well, he sounds awful. Good. That's his legacy now. That's the only thing that people will remember of that man.
Is that letter. Imagine if that was the final thing that you left.
Ooh.
Unlike Captain Jack Crawford.
Unlike Captain Jack. What is he been up to?
Who is the author of this week's poem?
Ooh. We need like a break bumper. We need like a stinger for the poems. We need like a local radio jingle. Poem. We have a drum kit in here. Edit that.
Do it.
No, that must be edited out.
It's poem time.
Okay, we'll work
on
that.
We love a poem.
We'll maybe make it rhyme.
We'll make it rhyme. For poem time.
This is the worst thing the studio has ever seen.
Okay. So this is called a New Year poem.
Oh, it's New Year. That's nice.
It's New Year. It's a New Year poem for our New Year episode. Don't blame the world. It's better than the man who wants to be a somebody, who lives to save the undertaker's fee. For surely he's a dead one on our strenuous preserves. A wooden coat 6 feet of earth is all that he deserves. Go chase yourself around the block, then chase around some more, and start the blood to circulate and sweat from every pore. Then change your face and change your socks and change your atmosphere and change your dope for heaven's brew to start the glad new year. But this is my advice to you. But have you got the sand to buck against temptation and to play a winning hand? If so, then shake, God speed you on. You'll win, just persevere. And if you've never been a man, begin with the new year.
What?
Basically, he said a lot of words, and in the middle suggested changing your face and your socks to start the new year right.
This is pretty good advice.
I mean, I've got the socks thing down pat.
Yeah, I've got some alpaca socks on. She's sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
The face thing, I feel, is more challenging.
Yeah, that is more challenging. I mean, it seems that every single episode, I come up with some horrific murder, usually of a woman, and you come up with just curmudgeonly old men. In poems
with
matches.
Great advice.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, everything we have this episode. But we want to say Happy New Year to everybody. And
Happy New Year,
Happy
everyone.
Happy New Year, everyone. And we hope that you have a great 2017 and that it involves a lot of rating and reviewing on iTunes. Or wherever you get your podcast.
That was flawless.
Thank you very much.
My favourite thing to do.
Studio Jim. So yeah, that would really help us out. And follow us on Twitter at Paper Podcast. And as usual, playing us out is...
Oh, I forgot about them.
Johnny Big Pants and the Face Changers.
It is Al Jolson and Sophie Taylor with the International Rag.
International Rag.
With
thanks to
the
Free Music Archive. Also, as a side note, I should have said this earlier, the British Newspaper Archive, if you do use it or whatever, all images are copyright the British Library.
And all of the archives that we used for the researching of this podcast and all the other resources as well can be found in the episode description.
Bye. International, the International Rag.